packed my bags. Last night, pre-flight. 0 hour. 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high.
Welcome back, everybody.
By then.
We are the Smithsonian of culture.
Yes. All culture goes through us. Speaking of satire,
I miss the earth.
Or not. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
At the time, you really couldn't tell.
I miss my wife.
But I promised you I'd bring back some Shatner for you. Folks, here on WAUK 540 AM in Waukesha, that's also 101 FM The Shaw. And you're listening to us in Madison on 1580 AM, that's WTTN, as well as 92.7 FM, that's Devil Radio. Check us out on the Devil Radio app. I think it's going to be a long, long time. But don't take a long, long time to give us a call at 844-967-2789. Like I said, I promise you, it's Shatner.
Back again to find I'm not the man they think I am back home. Oh, no.
No, no.
I can see the loose tie. You know, the stage sweat.
But this has actually been parodied by Family Guy as well. Stewie did this entire thing incomplete. That was, it was awful and amazing.
Conway Twitty.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Conway Twitty. So yeah, that's that. We're gonna get into something else here. I got an Atlantic piece that I got loaded up for you. But I call out for calls 844-967-2789. And if you want to keep continuing the phone conversation, give us a call like Joe did at 844-967-2789. Hi Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Hello.
Hi Joe, you're with me on the air.
Hey. Excellent. It looks like it's Culture Hour, which is just fine by me.
Works for
and
me.
I wanted to drop something. I wanted to drop something in that I thought you might find interesting and kind of intriguing. I had no idea about this. I guess because the old memory only remembers certain parts. Let us look at a film from the 1980s, Dirty Dancing. Okay.
Oh yes, I actually have this loaded up and ready to go too. But please go for it.
Oh, okay. Set in 1963, it was made in 1987, and big difference between those two dates in terms of the availability of abortion. And I was, seen the film ages ago and completely forgot about the illegal abortion thread that goes through the narrative, which is really rather important in terms of setting up how the characters meet.
That's how the plot starts. That's the entire plot. It starts with an abortion.
Or the lack of... Then. I can,
please, Joe. Well, let me read this. This is the piece I have. When we think about Dirty Dancing, we think about the bottom image. That's Jennifer Grey crawling to Patrick Swayze. By the way, I just have to say I'm one degree of separation from this movie. I worked with Patrick Swayze in one of my bigger TV show deals on The Beast. Check it out, the pilot episode. Anyway, separate from that. When we think about Dirty Dancing, we often think about the picture on the bottom page, and that's Jennifer Grey crawling over to Patrick Swayze. We forget that the whole reason that Baby has to fill in for Penny is because Robbie gets Penny pregnant and refuses to take responsibility. We forget that the abortion is so expensive, Penny cannot afford it, even from a questionable practitioner. And when Robbie refuses to pay for it, Baby has to get the money for her. We forget that Penny nearly dies because abortions are illegal. We forget the horrible conditions she is forced to endure in order to get the abortion, and the incredible pain she was in afterwards. We forget her tears. We forget her shame. We forget the judgment and condemnation towards her. We forget Robbie's endorsement for college. The dude gets an endorsement for college and smug attitude as his life remained unchanged. While this is a movie, there have been real-life Pennies. And we must not return to the time where this is the norm. Abortions have never been an issue for the wealthy. Money affords opportunity and secrecy. The United States has the highest maternal mortality rate amongst industrialized countries. Banning abortions is not going to help that number. So, yeah. Thank you, Joe.
Amazing. Isn't it amazing? All that way back. And we remember the dance scene, but what set up the dance scene was this Penny's poor, terrible misfortune and the horror that she went through. So I think it really speaks to something that you were mentioning earlier in the week in terms of narratives and the stories that drive us. And I would just, it was fascinating because apparently that screenwriter said, it was a woman, and she said in 1987, she really fought to keep that element as part of the story. She said, people, oh, that's, no, we don't want to hear that terrible stuff. But she said, I want it to be known. People in 1987 assume that Roe is going, that abortions are going to be available. And I wanted to remind them that that wasn't always the case. And I thought another great way in which culture is always giving us narratives that educate and expand our minds, and that's why art is so important. Thanks.
Extremely important. Absolutely. Thank you for the call. Yeah, I got to echo that again. This movie, you know, it's not the greatest of everything either. It's not like I'm not going to put it on the greatest movies of all time as far as production or anything or acting goes or whatnot, but people love this movie. And maybe, and this is what I say about every movie, and I'm going to analogize Dumb and Dumber here, but every movie that really hits home, that really connects with people, has to have a moment of truth in it that connects the audience to that moment. You know, with E.T., it's the kid gets abandoned on a planet and he's alone and his mom left him. That's why I can't watch the rest of the movie, because I started crying and I have a fear of abandonment with my mom, but that's a different deal. Point is, a movie like Dumb and Dumber, if you remember the beginning, that movie's ridiculous. That movie is ridiculous and it is insane. But at the beginning of the movie, Jim Carrey has a monologue about, I'm tired of being a nobody. I'm tired of being, and it justified every stupid action he took for the rest of the movie. So in that same sense, this story of an abortion story that basically starts the entirety of the plot of Dirty Dancing going is the moment of truth that hits home for everybody. Even if it's like, you know, these are rich kids in the Catskills, you know, it's not like these are, you know, people without means, but you know, Patrick Swayze represents the blue collar element right there. And that's something that people can relate to. That's something that speaks to human beings and makes us go, I see myself in that, or I see my sister, or I see my mom, I see my daughter in that. And that's the thing that makes this movie. Yeah, there's great dancing scenes, and yeah, there's great, you know, great scenes in it, and memorable stuff. But it's that moment of truth that captures it and makes it feel like it's yours, or you relate to it so much. That's why you invest so much in these characters, whether they're acted amazingly or not. So, yeah, that's really great. I love it when people bring up exactly where I was going. That's pretty cool. All right, so we're gonna keep going here. I've been holding on to this piece for a little bit, and I think it's important to get into. And I love reading Atlantic pieces because they're informative as well as thought provoking. And I hope you think so as well. Please give me a call, 844-967-2789, if this blows the wind in your sails like it did to me. This is in the Atlantic, like I said. This is by Anne Applebaum, not Benita Applebaum. This is Anne Applebaum. There is no liberal world order. Unless democracies defend themselves, the forces of autocracy will destroy them. It's light reading for a Friday, I think. In February of 1994, in the Grand Ballroom in the Town Hall in Hamburg, Germany, the president of Estonia gave a remarkable speech. Standing before an audience in an evening dress, Lennart Meri praised the values of the democratic world that Estonia then aspired to join. Quote, the freedom of every individual, the freedom of the economy and trade, as well as the freedom of the mind, of culture and science, are inseparably interconnected, he told the burghers of Hamburg. They form the prerequisite of a viable democracy. You know, yeah, these are pretty awesome sentiments here. His country, having regained its independence from the Soviet Union 3 years earlier, believed in these values. Think of the end of the Berlin Wall. This is post that, I believe. The Estonian people never abandoned their faith in this freedom during the decades of totalitarian oppression. But Meri also had come to deliver a warning. Freedom in Estonia and in Europe could soon be under threat. Russian President Boris Yeltsin and the circles around him were returning to the language of imperialism, speaking of Russia as primus inter pares, the first among equals, in the former Soviet Empire. That doesn't sound right, dude, does it? In 1994, Moscow was already seething with a language of resentment, aggression, and imperial nostalgia. The Russian state was developing an illiberal vision of the world, and even then was preparing to enforce it. Murray called on the democratic world to push back. The West should, quote, make it emphatically clear to Russian leadership that another imperialist expansion will not stand a chance. At that, the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, at that time, one Vladimir Putin, got up and walked out of the hall. So we're talking about, you know, the end of the Soviet Empire, the end of the communist, the evil communist regime. And I have to say they give communism a bad name because then the way they practice it, lots of people died and a lot of stupid things happened. And a lot of it was because, I don't know, they cared too much about the, you know, people who made too much money and not necessarily about it, and people who had power and people in party. And also there's a whole bunch of, you know, paranoia and, you know, power more than over people and all. Stalin was a bad guy. But let's move on here, okay? I'm just trying to give you the background, the idea. This is emerging. This is the end of the Eastern Bloc, as it were. Mary's fears were at the time shared in all of the formerly captive nations of Central and Eastern Europe, and they were strong enough to persuade governments in Estonia, Poland, and elsewhere to campaign for admission in NATO. They succeeded because nobody in Washington, London, or Berlin believed that the new members mattered. The Soviet Union was gone. The deputy mayor of St. Petersburg was not an important person, and Estonia would never need to be defended. That was why neither Bill Clinton nor George W. Bush made much of an attempt to arm or reinforce the new NATO members. Only in 2014 did the Obama administration finally place a small number of American troops in the region, largely in an effort to reassure allies after the first Russian invasion of Ukraine. And by the way, this is in 2014. We're talking about 1994 is when this speech happened. So a little bit late, and at the time, when you come in that late, everyone kind of goes, what? So again, continuing on, nobody else anywhere in the Western world felt any threat at all. For 30 years, Western oil and gas companies piled into Russia, partnering with Russian oligarchs who had openly stolen the assets they controlled. Imagine the people, the company you keep. Western financial institutions did lucrative business in Russia too, setting up systems to allow those same Russian kleptocrats to export their stolen money and keep it parked anonymously in Western property and banks, Florida. We convinced ourselves that there was no harm in enriching dictators and their cronies. Trade, we imagined, would transform our trading partners because it's their economic system that's the problem, not the autocracy, right? Wealth would bring liberalism. Capitalism would bring democracy. And democracy would bring peace. And when they're talking about liberalism, they're not talking about liberalism in the way that you and I think about it as far as our parties are concerned. They're talking about liberalism as far as, you know, not oppressing your people. You know, having a democracy, not necessarily the liberalism as you and I think about it. Just for the rest of this article, that's what they're talking about. After all, it had happened before. Following the cataclysm in 39 to 45, Europeans had indeed collectively abandoned wars of imperial territorial conquest. They stopped dreaming of eliminating one another. Instead, the continent had become had been the source of the two worst wars the world had ever known, created the European Union, an organization designed to find negotiated solutions to conflicts and promote cooperation, commerce, and trade. Because of Europe's metamorphosis, especially because of the extraordinary transformation of Germany from a Nazi dictatorship into the engine of the continent's integration and prosperity. Europeans and Americans alike believed that they had created a set of rules that would preserve peace not only on their own continents, but eventually the whole world. The liberal world order relied on the mantra of never again. Never again would there be genocide. Never again large nations erase smaller nations from the map. Never again would we be taken in by dictators who use the language of mass murder. At least in Europe, we would know how to react when we heard it. But while we're happily living under the illusion that never again meant something real, the leaders of Russia, owners of the world's largest nuclear arsenal, were reconstructing an army and a propaganda machine designed to facilitate mass murder, as well as a mafia state controlled by the tiny number of men and bearing no resemblance to Western capitalism. For a long time, too long, the custodians of the liberal world order refused to understand these changes. They looked away when Russia pacified Chechnya by murdering tens of thousands of people. When Russia bombed schools and hospitals in Syria, Western leaders decided it wasn't their problem. When Russia invaded Ukraine for the first time, they found reasons not to worry. Surely Putin would be satisfied with the annexation of Crimea. When Russia invaded Ukraine the second time, occupying part of the Donbass, they were sure he would be sensible enough to stop, right? Right? We helped this happen. It's all of our fault. But there's some solutions. I'll get you those on the other side.
And I think it's going to be long.